This is part three. Yesterday we looked at the Kabbalistic perspectives on Mashiach. Today we're going to do something even more exciting, I think. We're going to come back to reincarnation, which we're going to look at tomorrow and on Thursday when we talk about Tchiyat HaMetim. But today I want to talk about Mashiach ben Yosef. We never even mentioned Mashiach ben Yosef yet, and we're going to talk a lot about today. Mashiach ben Yosef, meaning the Mashiach, which is not the regular Mashiach, Mashiach ben David, but the Mashiach descended from or attributed to or connected with Yosef. And we'll see what that means. Before I get into Mashiach ben Yosef, I want to talk about a related topic, which we'll see how they tie together, which we also haven't mentioned so far, which is Geula. 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 What does Geula mean?
Redemption.
What does redemption mean? What does that mean? Please define someone who is redeemed as opposed to someone who is not redeemed.
Like saved
from something that was bad. Saved servitude. Released from
taking back
something that you had before. Mm-hmm. Being freed from slavery in some way.
Forgiven.
No, I don't think it's forgiven. I'm not. Maybe, but I don't think it's necessarily essential. Geula is a very big buzzword, especially in the religious Zionist community in Israel, which focuses a lot on Geula. We're living in the time of Geula, and you can see the Geula is coming, and we daven all the time, and you can see, look around you. What do they mean when they talk about that? So one of the hot-button phrases that everyone hashkafically likes to get uptight about is that it's a prayer for the state of Israel, which they say in many shuls on Shabbat. And it starts, Avinu Sheba Shamayim, Tzu Yisrael V'Goalo, our Father in Heaven, which actually is very interesting why they picked Avinu Sheba Shamayim, which is not such a normal Jewish beginning to a prayer, but clearly sounds like the Lord's Prayer. If you're a Christian, you'll know what that is, our Father who art in heaven, etc. Yeah? You're also unexposed to Christian. You see, you grew up in America with a separation of church and state. I grew up in England, and if you go to a non-Jewish school in England, you sing hymns and do go to Christian prayers. Because the schools have that, okay?
Wow.
They did in 1975. Probably now they have other prayers as well, but whatever.
Was
it? Exactly. Yeah, I know all the Christmas carols, and I know all the hymns and everything. Mm-hmm. And the hers. okay, so it's a mixed school. So if you are, what did I get into that?
The Our Father in Heaven.
Yes. Avinu Sheba Shamayim, Tzu the Rock of Israel and its Redeemer. Okay, Hu Yivarechet Medinat Yisrael, may he bless the state of Israel. And then what's the key phrase that everyone gets hot on the collar about? No. Reshit Smichat Geulatenu. The beginning of the flowering. Remember I talked about the process, Messianic process being Mashiach, being a Semach, being a plant, organic. The beginning of the flowering of our redemption. Reshit Smichat Geulatenu. And there are some shuls which, if you don't say that, everyone screams, you've got to say Reshit Smichat Geulatenu. And there are some shuls which, if you say that, they say, we don't say that here. Mm-hmm. And there are some shuls where they put in, like, Shetahei, that we hope it's the beginning of our redemption, but we're not sure. And people get very excited about that. Now, I think, and I'm pretty sure about this, that a lot of people argue with each other because they're actually defining this in a different way. For the Haredi world, for the yeshivish world, if you ask people, what is Geula? Almost to a person, they will answer, Mashiach. Mashiach. Which is all the things we've been talking about in the last 2 days. If you ask a religious Zionist person in Israel who's had a decent education, what is Geula? They will probably not say Mashiach. They will say Geula is a process whereby, according to Tanakh, you get your land back if you'd lost it, and you get your freedom back if you'd lost it. If you open a Parashat Bahar, which is in Vayikra, towards the end of Vayikra, you will see there that Geula, as a halachic mitzvah, is discussed. And Geula happens there. It's not talking about sort of the final day's redemption, but it's talking about if a Jew owned ancestral land in the land of Israel back in the day, and was forced to sell it because they became poor, then there is an opportunity for a Goel, a redeemer, Goel, to get it back by buying it back for them. Or they can put the money together for themselves and get it back. A family member might get it back. Or if they lost their freedom, let's say they became so poor that they were sold as a slave to a non-Jewish person. Is it really cold in here?
Yeah.
Yeah. Can you does someone just put the, do you know how to do it? The air conditioning? Yeah, it's not gonna come, but just put it up a notch or two. Because if everyone's going blue, she's catching pneumonia here, Sydney. Yeah?
Absolutely serious.
Okay, fine. If a person lost their freedom, a Goel can come along, says the Psukim, and come and buy them back and get their freedom back. So in very halachic terms, the mitzvah of gula in the Torah is getting your land back when you lost your land and getting your freedom and autonomy and independence back when you lost that. The religious Zionist community turn around and say that what's happening in Israel over the last 150 years is a process of gula, but they're not necessarily talking about the Mashiach. Because if you define gula as people who've lost their land getting it back, and people who've lost their freedom getting it back, then it's just a matter of fact that the Jews living, the 7 million Cain Yerubu Jews living in the land of Israel today, have got land back that they lost, and freedom and autonomy back that they never used to have. That's not even a question of opinion. So if you ask a religious Jew today, do you think the state of Israel is a process of gula? So the yeshivish people will say no, because they think the gula means Mashiach, and I think we could all agree that this is not Mashiach by any definition that we've seen. It's not the Rambam's Mashiach where there's world peace and the Beis HaMikdash, and it's not the Kabbalistic Mashiach where we've all gone back to Gan Eden. It's not that, clearly, right? It's great, but it's not that. But if you ask a religious Zionist person, they'll say it is gula, because they're defining it in a different way. Maybe Mashiach will be in 100 years, maybe in 200 years, maybe tomorrow morning, whatever, but gula is right here and right now. And there can be no denying it if that's how you define it. But half the argument is because people aren't defining it the same way. Yes. Hi, Mushka.
You mentioned land and also
freedom.
Autonomy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, what do you mean by autonomy here?
The Jews used to be subject to the will of non-Jewish nations. For many hundreds of years, they were literally owned by the king or owned by the local ruler. And they had no woe fighting for them. You depend on their police force and their army. And if they like you today and not tomorrow, you're just at their whim. You're a complete... And that's how the Jews and Chutz La'aretz are still living on a certain level. In Israel, and of course it's not perfect and it's not complete, and who knows whether it's permanent, please God, it is, but who knows? Right now you have an autonomy that you don't have anywhere else in the world. You have a Jewish army police force who are going to protect you. Okay? You don't have that anywhere else. Okay, so gula is a separate thing, but you see it's related. Yes, Kandora.
But can you really say that we have autonomy if so many of Israel's political decisions have to be basically approved?
So that's a perfectly good question.
The interests of the American
people. And the question is always, how much autonomy is enough autonomy to be called autonomy? It's never a total thing. Let's say somebody buys your land back in the biblical time. Oh yeah, I own my land back. Great, but you're still completely broke. And you have no way to do anything, but I got my land back. Yeah, but what are you going to do? So autonomy doesn't mean you have perfect autonomy. If you go back to the time of the first temple, for example, or the second temple, take the second temple, take the Maccabim. Yeah, the Maccabim, who, Hanukkah story, got the land of Israel back from the Greeks. So how successful was the Maccabean revolt? We celebrate Hanukkah. The Rambam says we say Hallel every single day on Hanukkah, full Hallel with a bracha, because of Hallel, because of the redemption, because of the Geula of the Maccabim. And we had our own state for 200 years. The Rambam writes this in the Laws of Hanukkah. But what kind of a state did we have? So for a short time when the original Maccabees were in, then it was not bad. But then, of course, then they lost to the Greeks. The Greeks quickly took it back. So it wasn't very long lasting. And then the Maccabim themselves started becoming heretics. And then there was a Jewish civil war, literally Jews killing Jews under the Maccabeans, Hyrcanus and Aristobulus, like the fourth generation of Maccabim, killing each other and people and Jewish blood running all over. And then the Romans came in. We actually invited them in. Yeah, we invited them in, and then they came in and we said, thank you very much. You don't have to stay now. And they said, well, no, that's not how it works. We're here to stay. And then the Romans came and completely terrorized the Jewish community for 100 years. And yet, we still call that enough of a geula that we say Hallel on Hanukkah every single day for the Maccabim and what they gave us. Now, what we have today is way better than anything we ever had in those 200 years. Even if Trump calls up and says, you can't bomb this or you can't do this. Yeah? Go back to the first temple when we had our own kings. We had King Chizkiyahu HaMelech and Yoshayahu HaMelech. Open up every page of Tanakh and we're still being, pressured by Egypt to do this, and Assyria to do that, and Babylon to do this. We're constant. We're a little people, always kind of pulled in different directions by lots of big nations. That's just who we are. We have this special geographical position. That's why God says to Abraham to come here, because we are at the cross section between three continents. Yeah, everything comes through Israel. The world is obsessed with Israel. That's just that. You don't have to be Jewish to know that. It's always been that way. It's remarkable. You know, the French Revolution, 1789. So the French Revolution destroyed France. They had no bureaucracy. They had no monarchy. They had no civil service. They had nothing. They had nothing. They start from ground zero. And if you look how many times the new French Parliament debated the Jewish problem in those first like 5 or 6 years after the revolution, there were no Jews in France. But they were obsessed passing resolutions again and again and again and again about the Jewish problem. What's wrong with you? You've got no sewage. You've got no bureaucracy. You've got nothing. You've got anarchy in the country. Why are you obsessed with... Does that ring any bells? It's just a reality. We've always been in this reality. We've been this little country, and everyone seems to be unduly obsessed with us. So are we really autonomous? Not completely. We're never going to be like Putin. He's probably autonomous, as much as autonomous as you can get. I don't think I'd want to be like him, honestly. But anyway, leave it aside. Yes, question. Someone had a question. Yes.
Where in the Tanakh does it refer to Geula as coming back to the land?
Okay, Parshas Behar, Parshas Nitzavim. Look at the end of Nitzavim. Talk about that. That Ga'al Ticha, the whole process of Yetzias Mitzrayim is a Geula, yeah? Chodesh HaGeula, the month of redemption. Nisan is a month of Geula. What kind of Geula was that? That was taking the Jews out of slavery in Egypt to bring them to the Promised Land. That's what Geula is. It's just on every page of Tanakh. Mm-hmm. Yeah? Reshit, what do we call it? Zman Geula, Zman Cheirutenu. Okay, Cheirut is another thing, which is... But Geula is very mainstream. Very, very mainstream. This is not something some religious Zionist thought of in the, you know, the 1850s, mm-hmm. 1870s. Yes?
Is this why the Hanukkah story, is that the argument for saying...
That is very much part of the argument. Then people say, should you say Hallel on Yom HaAtzmaut? Yeah, when we've got a country of our own. Oh no, it's run by non-religious people and it's got like wars and blah. Well, is it better than the Hashmonaim or not better than the Hashmonaim? Okay, so that's part of the argument. Anyway, that's not for now, and I'm not getting into that whole discussion. What's that got to do with Mashiach ben Yosef? A lot. Look with me now. Have a look, please, on page 13. Page 9. I'm going to do as much of this as I can today. Everyone with me? Everyone has a sheet? Everyone? Yeah, good. The Gemara in Sukkah talks about Mashiach ben Yosef. And it says as follows. Ve've'eini Hashem arba charashim. Zachariah, the Navi, end of First Temple period, beginning of Second Temple period. He says, I saw the vision of four craftsmen. Charashim are craftsmen. Yeah? Artisans. Says the Gemara, Man nihu arba charashim. Who are these four craftsmen that Zachariah saw? Says the Gemara, Amar Rav Chuna bar Bizna, Amar Rav Shimon Chasida. Says as follows. They are the following. Mashiach ben David, Mashiach, the Messiah descended from King David. Mashiach ben Yosef, the Mashiach of the Yosef. Eliyahu, and Kohen Tzedek. Not getting into who Kohen Tzedek is. Is it Shem? I'm not getting into that now. Leave Cohen Sedek to one side. Why are these people called craftsmen? So look in number 2, Rashi says, Charashim, craftsmen, umanim, artisans. And he says it like this, Mashiachim Shnehem. Both Mashiachs have to be Charashim, artisans. Why? The Binyan Bet Hamikdash. Because they both have to build the Bet Hamikdash. Now, A, that's an interesting Rashi, because we saw Rashi yesterday, the famous Rashi, this is a less famous Rashi. Yesterday we saw Rashi that said that the temple comes down from Shemaim, right? Remember that? People will quote that to you. Oh, but Rashi says the temple's going to come down from Shemaim. So when you hear that quoted, then you say, yeah, but Rashi, yeah, 10 daf before in the Gemara, says also the Mashiach is going to build a Beis HaMikdash. Not just the one Mashiach, but both Mashiachs. Is it the same Beis HaMikdash? The same temple? Different partners? Let's carry on. Look in number 5. We'll skip 3 and 4 for now. There's other references towards Mashiach ben Ephraim. And Mashiach ben Ephraim is the same as Mashiach ben Yosef. Because Ephraim is the son of Yosef, right? Okay, fine. Look in number 5. The Gemara continues in Sukkah. Bayom Hahu, says Zechariah the prophet. Bayom Hahu, on that day, the day of Mashiach ben Yosef, when these four craftsmen are coming, Yigdala Misped be Yerushalayim. There will be a great hesped. What's a hesped? A eulogy. Someone's died. They're giving a eulogy. Kemisped Hadad Rimon be Bekat Megidon. As big as the hesped over Hadad Rimon. That is an oblique reference to the hesped over King Achav. King Achav, one of the wicked kings of the first temple. Okay, when he was killed, there was a massive eulogy for King Achav, Jewish king, the northern kingdom. There'll be an even bigger eulogy, says the Gemara. It's kind of in the Pasuk, sorry. The Safta Haaretz, and the land will eulogize, Mishpachot, Mishpachot, Levad. Each family will have its own little eulogy section. Mishpachat Bet David Levad, and David's family will have the eulogy section, Unashehem Levad, and their wives will be separate to them, and they will also have their eulogy. Now, completely different shear, but if you're looking for a source that's based on for the idea that men and women have to sit separately at weddings, separate seating at weddings, this is your source. Because apparently in this funeral, in this eulogy, in the future, the men and the women are going to have to be separated. And come along some of the later Mephoroshim and say, look, even in a funeral, you can't have mixing of men and women when everybody's crying and everybody's sad. All the more so at a wedding when everybody's dressed up and everybody's drunk and everybody's flirty and everybody's crazy. You certainly can't have a mixing of men and women. Now, that is a whole shiur in and of itself, and I am not telling you that you have to have separate seating at a wedding, because there are other sources that come around and say, no, nothing to do with it, you do not. You have to have separate dancing at a wedding, but you do not have to have separate seating at a wedding. This has been a debate in the Jewish world for at least 500 years. At least 500 years. So if you say to me, well, it's the difference between a wedding in Lakewood and a wedding in Teaneck, the answer is, yeah, and the last 500 years as well, because it's always, not for now. So there's going to be this big funeral. Okay, so says the Gemara, Ha hespeda mai avidate. What is this funeral for? Who died? What are they crying about? So two views. Pligibe Rabbi Dosa and Rabbanon. Rabbi Dosa and Rabbanon disagree, says the Gemara. One said, Al Mashiach ben Yosef shenera. It's Mashiach ben Yosef has died. They're all desperately sad. Mashiach ben Yosef has died. The other view, which I didn't bring you on the sheet, is that they're all sad because the Yetzahara has been killed. That was yesterday's shiur, yeah? The Yetzahara, the evil inclination, has been taken away, and they're all crying because of that. That was yesterday's shiur. Why are they crying? Because they have no more Yetzahara? Because they can't do any mitzvahs anymore. It's too late. They've missed their chance. They're now in Gan Eden. There's no Yetzahara. That's yesterday's shiur, okay? The other view is they're crying because Mashiach ben Yosef has died. Has been killed. Not just died. Has been killed. So what's going on? Why are you crying over a killed Messiah? Who is he? Number six, and then we'll get into it. Vesara kina Ephraim, Yeshayahu says. And what's going to happen at the end of days is that the jealousy of Ephraim is going to go away. Vetzorere Yehuda yikareso. And those who oppress Yehuda will be cut down. Ephraim lo yikane et Yehuda. Ephraim will not be jealous of Yehuda. Yehuda lo yatzor et Ephraim. And Yehuda will not afflict Ephraim. Who are Yehuda and Ephraim? What are these two groups? In history, in the history of Israel, who is Yehuda and Ephraim? The two kingdoms. Meaning you have the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom, basically like this. You have Yisrael in the north, which is Ephraim and Manasseh, which is Yosef. And then you have Yehuda in the south. Yehuda and Binyamin in the south. So this jealousy between the two, which of course is started with the brothers, yeah? When the brothers are jealous of Yosef and they want to kill Yosef, it's Yehuda versus Yosef. Always those two. So Yeshayahu says there'll come a time when these two forces within the Jewish people, all of the machlokas, all of the fighting in the Jewish people, is a result of this original split. By the way, who caused that fighting? Who is responsible for that fighting? What do we say in the Haggadah? Not the Romans. Goes way before the Romans. It's in the Tanakh. No, who's responsible for that fighting between the Jewish people? No. Not Yaakov. Who's responsible? No. No. Now you're just guessing. Okay? What do we say in the Haggadah? We say, Ma say ulaman. Ma bikesh Lavan ha'arami. Yeah, what did Lavan want to do to the Jewish people? What's it got to do with Lavan? Because Lavan, at the end of the day, put this poison into the Jewish people between each other. Because why were the Jewish people in Mitzrayim? We say in the Haggadah, why were they in Egypt? Because?
Lavan
Followed it through, followed the chain. Why were they in Egypt? Because?
Brothers sent Yosef.
Because Yosef was in Egypt. Why was Yosef in Egypt? Because the brothers sold into Egypt. Why did they sell into Egypt? Because they were jealous. Why were they jealous? Because he was favored by his father. And why was that not appropriate that he was favored by his father? Because he wasn't the firstborn. But he would have been the firstborn if not for Lavan. Because Lavan should have given Rachel to Yaakov, not Leah to Yaakov. And then everything would have been easy peasy. So all of the fighting within the Jewish people. At the end of days, that's going to go away. Says Rashi, look at the Rashi at the end of number 6. Says Rashi, what does this mean? Mashiach ben Yosef, Mashiach ben David, lo yiknu zeh bazeh. These two Mashiachs will not be jealous of each other. Yeah.
So why do we say that Yosef was jealous of, like, Ephraim was jealous of Yehuda? Like, Yosef was the favorite child.
Right, but then he was sold by Yehuda. So Yosef hates Yehuda because he sold him, and Yehuda hates Yosef because he's favorite and thinks he's superior. Everybody hates everybody.
Oh, so it's not that they're jealous of each other.
No, they hate each other and they fight each other, and there's this inbuilt fighting. It comes down to that all the time. Okay. What's this got to do with anything to do with us? Go over the page, please. So I'll leave you to read number 7. Actually, let's read it real quick. Someone read number 7 real quick in English. Can anyone read English? Kayla, thank you. I just got this off a Chabad website, which was helpful, but you can find this all over the place. Carry on.
The central task of Mashiach ben Yosef is to act as the person of Mashiach ben David. He will prepare the world for the coming of the final Redeemer. Different sources attribute to him different functions, some even charging him with the tasks traditionally associated with Mashiach ben David, such as the gathering of the exiles, the rebuilding of the Beit HaMikdash, and so forth.
And we saw that just now. Both Mashiachs build the Mikdash. Carry on.
The principal and final function ascribed to Mashiach ben Yosef is of political and military nature.
Oh, political and military. We're going to see this in a minute. Yeah.
He shall wage war against the forces of evil that oppress Israel. More specifically, he will do battle against Edom, descendants of Esav. Edom is the comprehensive designation of the enemies of Israel.
And by the way, there's a whole thing between Edom and Yishmael. Maybe it's Yishmael, maybe it's Edom. There's two different approaches. Okay, fine.
And it will be crushed through the progeny of Joseph. The immediate results of this war will be disastrous. Mashiach ben Yosef will be killed. This is described in the prophecy of Zechariah, who says of this tragedy that they shall mourn him as one mourns for an only child. His death will be followed by a period of great calamities. These new tribulations shall be the final test for Israel, and shortly thereafter, Mashiach ben David shall come, avenge his death, resurrect him, and inaugurate the messianic era of everlasting peace.
Okay, good. Now, that's not necessarily the only way of reading it, but Mashiach ben Yosef, according to this, which I agree with, is a lead-in process. He's a lead-in to the real time of ultimate Mashiach. And I want to show you this in Rav Sadia Gaon in number 8, and then we're going to get into Rav Kook. Look at number 8. The Omer Achrezeh, I want to tell you as follows. Who's Rav Sadia Gaon? Sadia Gaon, one of the Gaonim, living in the 9th century, very early. Yeah, one of the first people to actually set down Jewish thought, Jewish philosophy, Jewish hashkofa, machshava. He wrote a book called Emunot V'Deot, which people still relearn, Emunot V'Deot, like beliefs and opinions and understanding. Okay, and he says there these two lines. Ve'omei achrezeh, I want to tell you, number 8. Ki al shnei inyanim yachad. These two things have to be understood together. Rotzeh lomar, what do I mean? Im lo nachzor b'tshuva, if we don't do tshuva, and we haven't even talked about this, that's a whole shiur on itself. How does geula and tshuva connect? Do the Jewish people have to do tshuva in order for geula to come or not? What does tshuva mean, by the way?
To return.
To what?
To Hashem.
Are you sure? That's nice. I don't know if anyone before 1995 would have even knew what that meant, but okay. Okay, like what were you were like, you know, schizophrenic before? Like, return, what could return mean? Return to God, meaning return to the Torah, start keeping mitzvahs. If you look at the way return is used in the Torah when it talks about it, it always have a double meaning. It means return to God and
return to the land.
And it's a very interesting debate as to whether the tshuva of the Jewish people that is needed at the time of Mashiach is a return to God and or a return to the land. Which is very interesting, and it's not straightforward. We always think of tshuva as, yeah, well, people have to be Shomer Shabbos. Well, okay, but what if people come to Israel and they're not Shomer Shabbos? Is that a kind of tshuva? Is that worse or is that better? And that's also a big hashkafic debate, by the way, today. If you ask the Haredi world, is it better that people should be Mechallel Shabbos in Brooklyn or in Israel? They will say, well, is it better for them to be Mechallel Shabbos?
Brooklyn.
In Brooklyn. you're going to come to Israel and then do Aveiros here? Shkoyach, that's just what we needed. People to come to Israel and do Aveiros. There are views that mitzvahs don't even account the same way in Brooklyn. Rashi and the Ramban say, based on the Chumash, that the reason we keep mitzvahs in Chutz La'aretz is so that when we eventually get back to Israel, we'll know what they are. But really, they're not the same. You know, there are people who, if they put tefillin on in the morning in America or in England or whatever, and they fly to Israel, they put tefillin again. Because they didn't really do tefillin. They did the England tefillin. Not either. So coming to break Shabbos in this country is like terrible, terrible, terrible. That's one approach. There's another approach, which is, no, tshuva means to come back to the land of Israel and basically accept God as, you know, God. Not necessarily completely shomer mitzvahs. You're not keeping Shabbos. You're not really keeping perfectly. But you're back in Israel and connected in some way with Hashem. That's a very different approach. According to that approach, it's much better for you to be in Israel. By the way, you might say practically, the great-grandson of a chassid in Brooklyn is way more likely to marry out than the great-grandson of a secular Jew living in Tel Aviv.
What?
Way
more likely what?
To marry out.
It's worse to marry.
It's much more likely that the great grandchild of a chassid living in Brooklyn will marry a non-Jew than the secular Israeli living in Tel Aviv.
Right.
Where's the secular? Where's he going to find a non-Jew? He's going to marry an Arab. There are non-Jews. I mean, there are a few. Like, yeah.
I don't understand how it could be better to
what?
Not be shomer Shabbos in this country versus be shomer Shabbos.
Okay, so I'm not saying it is. I'm just saying that there is a view. That not in the Midrashim, it's explicit, which says that halavai, the Jewish people, should be back in Israel, even though they're not keeping mitzvahs. It's a clear, it's explicit Midrash. So there have always been two voices on this. There were people in the 1880s who wanted to give money to secular Jews in Israel to send them back to Russia so they can be secular in Russia. We don't need more here. And there were other people who were desperately trying to bring them to Israel. And put in a very crass way, yeah, let's say somebody in America says, is it better for me to be in America and my kids to be frumer, or to be in Israel and my kids to be less frum?
Mm-hmm.
Let's put it in its most vulgar and crass expression. And you'd have to define frum. Does it mean they won't look like that? And whatever. That's a very important question. That's a question on a lot of people's minds right now. People who say, well, I would come to Israel, but my kids are all going to go crazy. First of all, that's a narrative, and it's not necessarily the truth. And secondly, you have to define how that works. And then that's not for now. It's a whole different class, but I just want to put it out there. Fine. Says Rav Sadia Gaon, if we do tshuva, go back to number 8. If we do tshuva, im lo nachzor b'tshuva, if we don't do tshuva, sorry, v'yiyu hamoraim shel ben Yosef, and all these disasters of ben Yosef will come. Again, what does tshuva mean? We just discussed that. V'im nachzor b'tshuva, but if we do tshuva, then they won't happen. We don't need Mashiach ben Yosef. We can skip all this terrible tragedy. Yerulana Mashiach ben David piton. Then Mashiach ben David will come piton. Piton?
Right away, suddenly.
The Imi Yemen Mashiach ben Yosef, and if there is going to be a Mashiach ben Yosef, but if we play our cards right, if we do tshuva, Yeka Shaliach, then he won't be a disaster, he'll be a Shaliach. What's a Shaliach?
A messenger.
Metaken ha'uma, and we'll fix up the people. We'll be metaken the people, do tikkun on the people. Ukemesakel haderech, and like a pave till pave the road. Meaning, says Rav Sadia Gaon, already 1,200 years ago, Mashiach ben Yosef can go in two directions. If we get our act together, maybe we won't have it at all, or maybe we won't have it in a terrible way. But if we do get our act together, or if we get our act together, maybe we'll have it, but it'll be exactly what it was meant to be, not a disaster, but a precursor. Someone that's going to pave the way, create the nation, pave the road for Mashiach ben David to come. Now, having said all of that, have a look here at Rav Kook. Let's look at number 11. We're going to spend the rest of the shiur looking at this piece of Rav Kook on page 11. Rav Kook was the chief rabbi of Jaffa. He came in 1904 to Jaffa from Russia. He was a rov in Russia for many decades before that. He came, I think, in his 30s, maybe 40s, maybe early 40s to Jaffa. Jaffa was a very mixed community. There were Arabs living there. There was no Tel Aviv yet. Tel Aviv was 1908, something like that, but certainly not 1904. There were Arabs, there were secular Jews, and there were religious Jews living in Jaffa. So Rav Kook comes as the chief rabbi of Jaffa. It's a very contentious position. The old Yishuv, the old Yishuv, meaning the what you now we now call the Haredi Israeli community, which of course then was tiny compared to today, living in Hebron, living in Yerushalayim, living in Tveria, yeah, living in Sfat. They looked at Rav Kook with a lot of suspicion, because Rav Kook, even though he looked like an Eastern European rabbi, he had a lot of very interesting new ideas. He supported the Zionist movement, the secular Zionist movement as well, yeah? And he wanted people to move to Israel, and he reached out, he did Kiruv, he did outreach, he didn't just write these people off. So they looked at him as like, what is this modern guy with these modern ideas? And the new Yishuv, the Jews who were coming to live in Israel, many of them secular at this point, this is the second Aliyah, okay, looked at Rav Kook as part of the problem. You're just one of these rabbis, you're just pretending to be nice to us, and you really just want us to all be ultra-Orthodox, yada, yada. So Rav Kook was pulled in lots of directions, and everyone was kind of seeing what he was going to turn out like. So he was probably expecting to try and keep it quiet, keep his head down, you know, get to know people, and have a nice, easy ease into being the Rav of Yafo. It didn't work out that way. Because about a month after he arrived on the 28th of Iyar, in 1904, which became Yom Yerushalayim in 1967, which is a nice, good day to remember. It's also Shmuel Hanavi's Yahrzeit, which is not for now. And about a month later, Theodor Herzl dropped dead. Now, Theodor Herzl was, of course, the leader of the secular Zionist movement. In 1897 already, he did the first Zionist Congress, and this was 1904. It was really getting going. And the people and the secular Israeli Zionists came to Rav Kook and said, you're the chief rabbi, you have to give a hesped. You have to give a eulogy for Theodor Herzl. He was like the king of the Jews. He was almost like a messianic figure to these people. You know the famous pictures of him like, looking over the bridge, you know, with a beard. You know what I'm talking about?
No.
You know who Theodor Herzl was, right?
Yeah.
I hope you do. I hope you had so much
fun.
No, no, Rav Kook, Rav Theodor Herzl with a beard and
the
Judenstaat and whatever, Alt Neuland. Fine. So, by the way, he lived down the road from Sigmund Freud. From Sigmund Freud.
Yeah.
Rav Kook lived down the road from Sigmund Vienna. They lived on the same area. And Freud knew Herzl as his daughter's friend's daddy.
Oh my God.
The kids were in school together, so he just knew as the guy that did school pickup, you know. Oh, there's a guy with the long beard. Yeah, it's very interesting. Well, it's interesting. These two people living right next to each other. Okay, fine. So the Frum Jews came to Rav Kook and said, "You can't give a hesped for Theodor Herzl. He was a Machalel Shabbos. He ate on Yom Kippur. He was completely non-religious, which he was." And it says in the Shulchan Aruch, "You can't give a hesped. You don't eulogize that someone like that when they die." It's prohibited. So what's he going to do? He's damned if he does, and he's damned if he doesn't. What's he going
to
do?
Is usher to give a eulogy about somebody who's not...
Back in the day, when a non-Shomer Shabbos Jew was someone who had actively rebelled against and left the community. Mm. You could argue that even by the time of Theodor Herzl, he didn't actively rebel against. He was born a secular Jew, and he grew up a secular Jew.
What?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, he wasn't born a religious Jew. I think he had a religious grandfather, but he wasn't born in a religious family. Now, what did Rav Kook do? Rav Kook stood up and gave this speech, of which this is an extract, which became the manifesto for the religious Zionist movement.
Wait, sorry, before I begin, I feel like you can say Herzl did Tshuva because he literally brought us back.
Oh, so, yeah, okay. If you define Tshuva in that way, then Herzl becomes part of the solution religiously, not part of the problem. And we're going to see that coming out from Rav Kook right here and right now. Because it's not about Herzl the man, it's about Herzl, the idea, and secular Zionism, the idea. Mm-hmm. We'll see that coming out right now. Yes?
I just want to, like respond to that. I remember when we went to Har Herzl, the tour guide said that, like, he didn't care about coming back to Israel. He just wanted a place for Jews to be because after the war and everything that happened. He didn't care about Israel specifically.
I think to say he didn't care is an overstatement. He felt that, on balance,
I
think that's too strong. I think the Uganda plan, which Herzl supported, he felt was that all they could achieve right now was the Uganda plan, and that was better than nothing. But it was rejected by the Zionist Congress. Yeah. So the idea that Herzl didn't care about where they went, they could have just as easily been in Nevada as being in. I don't think that's true. I think he would have gone for another alternative. Yeah. But I'm not. I wouldn't have put it in those terms. Okay. So let's go. You're going to read this out very loudly, or maybe I'll read it out. You want to read it out?
Yeah.
Okay. Fine. So let's start at the very beginning, and he starts with the pasuk from Zechariah. which I'll start with. On that day, the lamentation will be great in Jerusalem, like the lamentation of Hadad Rimon in the valley of Megiddon. Okay, fine. Actually, there's something. I like you, and I like your reading, but I'm going to read it.
That's
so I'm going to skip around, and we're going to do
yeah,
that.
No.
Okay, fine. So let's look at what he says. Says Rav Kook, so it came about, because this was in Hebrew, obviously it's translated. So it came about throughout the exile that there is a seesaw effect of these two opposing forces. At times there is exhibited a drive towards the material worldly success that flows primarily from the foundation of Joseph and Ephraim, and at other times there is a stirring of the spiritual drive for observance of Torah and spiritual development for awe and the love of God. Rav Kook starts off by saying Yisrael and Yehuda are not just two parts of the Jewish people which can fight with each other geographically or whatever, or hashgaphically. He says these are the two things the Jews do really well. Joseph, Yosef, Ephraim, he is the Jew that makes money, and he makes it really well. He is the businessman. He is the Egyptian Jew in Egypt. That's what Yosef is, with an Egyptian name. What's his name?
Safnat
Paaneach, which is an Egyptian name. An Egyptian wife, Osnat Bat Potipharah. An Egyptian car, fancy car, which is his big chariot. And an Egyptian house in Memphis. Memphis, Egypt. Yeah? Not Memphis, Tennessee. Yeah? Yeah? He is Hamashbir. He is the one who provides. He is the one that has all of the keys to the finance. He is the one with the money. He is the Jew in Chutz La'aretz living as a tzaddik. He's a righteous person, but he has all of the universalist perspectives of the Jew that makes money. That's Yosef. Yehuda is the frum Jew, is the yeshiva bocher, is the Rosh Yeshiva. Jews are good at two things. They're good at learning Torah, and they're good at making money. Okay? Or money for money, read like finance, high tech, you know, winning Nobel Prizes, being the universal, you know, humans of the world. Second paragraph. Since it's impossible for our nation to attain its lofty destiny other than by actualizing these two components, says Rav Kook, we need both. We need both. The universal symbolized by Yosef and the distinctive symbolized by Yehuda, there arise in the nation proponents of each aspect. Some Jews are into that. Some Jews are into this. Some Jews are promoting the universal, you know, human, mankind, Nobel Prize model of Judaism. And some Jews are building yeshivas. Those who would enhance spirituality prepare the way for Mashiach ben David, whose focus is the final destiny. And truly, the focus of life is spiritual attainment, except that the spiritual can only develop properly if it's accompanied by all the material acquisitions of which a full-blooded, full-bodied nation is in need. Those who redress the material general aspects of life prepare the way for Mashiach ben Yosef. You can maybe even smell where he's going with this. In order to build Mashiach, to build the final end of days, you need a Jewish nation which is proud and wealthy and able and materially well off, with an economy, with an army. That's the job of Mashiach ben Yosef, to prepare the way. And then there can be the spiritual revolution of Mashiach ben David, which is where that now successful country, financially successful country, can then become religiously observant and become Mashiach ben David. But you can't have one without the other. You can't, if ein kemach, ein Torah, then in ein Torah, ein kemach. That's from Pirkei Avos, right? Without flour, without money, then you can't learn Torah. You're going to be able to put food on the table. And without Torah, what's the purpose of the money? The money is just, it's just for nothing. It's just for the sake of money. So he says, you need both. Now, when these two forces, third paragraph, work across purposes, or as a result of the calamity of exile, short-sightedness, and disarray, they are the birth pangs of Mashiach, or rather Mashiach's plural. He brings the pasuk there. Why do these two forces fight each other? Why are the secular Jews, who want to turn Israel into the Singapore of the Middle East, fighting the yeshivas, who want to turn Israel into the Slobodka of the Middle East? Why are they fighting each other? It's because they don't realize, says Rav Kook, that they're meant to be partnering with each other. It's part of the old fight between Yisrael and Yehuda. They should be working together and not fighting with each other. And when they fight with each other, that's called the birth pangs of Mashiach. That's the birthing pangs. Yeah? When a woman is about to give birth, well, you know what birth pangs are, but it's like excruciating. Why is this happening to me? And the answer is you're about to give birth to a new life, but right now it's a disaster. Yeah.
Differentiating the Gula and the Mashiach.
Yeah.
He's not saying that It's going to bring Geula, it's going
to
bring Mashiach.
Okay, good. It's a good question as to how that works, and Geula and Mashiach. I'm not, it's a good question as to, I'm not working everything together, but he's sort of, Mashiach ben Yosef may be the process of Geula, by the way. Geula may be Mashiach ben Yosef. Getting our land back, getting our autonomy back, making our money, building the state. And Mashiach ben David is the end of that process. So maybe Geula and Mashiach ben Yosef are basically the same thing. Okay, now, since the major achievement of Messiah ben Yosef, which is the general advancement of mankind, is accomplished by the de-emphasis of the unique form, Mashiach ben Yosef cannot endure, so he's destined to be killed. Look what Rav Kook is doing. He's saying Mashiach ben Yosef is not a person. Mashiach ben Yosef is an ideology. It's a movement. Mashiach ben Yosef is secular Zionism. Mashiach ben Yosef is secular Zionism. He's not saying Theodor Herzl is the Mashiach. People said afterwards, oh, you said Theodor Herzl is the Mashiach. No, he didn't say that. He said secular Zionism is Mashiach ben Yosef because what? Because it's trying to build the material wealth of a country. And it's essential. But that ideology has to die. Because it has to realize that the purpose of money is not money. The purpose of money is so we can connect with God. So it's not that the secular Zionists will die. It's that the secular Zionists will produce something and eventually realize that that thing is not the ultimate goal. That thing is just a means to an end. And therefore the idea of making us the Singapore of the Middle East, that's going to die. We don't want to be the Singapore of the Middle East now. We really want to be a religious nation, but a religious nation with high tech and with an army and with etc., etc. Now, when all this happens, we will recognize the perversity of the situation. They will realize that it was wrong not to subjugate the universal dimension of the spiritual aspect. All the secular Jews will realize that they weren't meant to be fighting Torah, etc. And then he uses the moshel of the only child that dies. And he says, when a person's only child dies, it's a tragedy, but it's not the end of the end of the road. If a person, an elderly couple, have a child that dies, then there's nothing more they can do. But if a person have a first child, a firstborn child that dies, they realize they messed it up, but they can have more children. So it's not hopeless. And then look at the next paragraph. By the same token, the nation, this is the most important paragraph, the nation comes to a realization, he's predicting what's going to be in Israel. This was in 1904. The nation comes to the realization that it did not know how to make proper use of this universalist dimension. Didn't understand how it could contribute to Israel's unique destiny. In that way, it could have survived. The nation labored under the illusion brought on by the divisiveness of exile that these two forces are truly at odds. The result is that whoever holds up the universal side of the nation, i.e. the secular Zionist, you want to make a financial nation, becomes unfortunately an enemy of Torah and mitzvahs. You're an enemy of Torah and mitzvahs. So he just turned around to the secular Zionists, who he's calling Mashiach ben Yosef, and says, you don't realize what you're meant to be, and you've become an enemy of Torah and mitzvahs. So that's nice. They're really going to like him for calling them an enemy of Torah and mitzvahs. And then he looks at the yeshivas, he looks at the Rosh Yeshiva, and he says, contrarywise, whoever's focus is on the uniquely Jewish, you don't care about money, in theory, you just want to learn Torah, becomes an adversity of material well-being. Like, what's your problem with money? Why do you seem to be working against money? In the first scenario, the fence of Torah is broken down. If the secular Zionists win alone, then you've lost Torah. In the second, the result is weakness and morosity. What's morosity? What's morosity?
Depression.
Rav Kook looks around at the secular Zionists. This is his speech to try and bring everybody together, right? He looks at the secular Zionists and says, look at you, you're an enemy of Torah mitzvahs. And he looks at the yeshivas and says, look at you, you're weak and you're sad. You're a weak, sad bunch of like weeds. What's wrong with you? How to make friends and influence people, right? So what Rav Kook is really telling them is, you need to join together. You big, muscly army guys, you're meant to be learning Torah in the army. And you yeshiva people are meant to be learning Torah and fighting the wars of Hashem. You're meant to be making a partnership. This is the ultimate partnership. And then he says, this is all going to change. Go over the page. Everybody will realize the mistake. There'll be a great lamentation. The two forces were created to be united. Da, 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 da. And then he says at the end, the Zionist vision manifest in our generation might best be symbolized as the footsteps of Mashiach ben Yosef. Zionism tends to universalism as opposed to Jewish particularism. Which is true, they wanted to make Jews just like the rest of humanity, a new Jew. It is unequipped to realize that the development of Israel's general aspect is but the foundation of Israel's singularity. The leadership of the Zionist movement must be greatly influenced by the gifted few of the generation, the righteous and the sages of Israel. He's saying to the left wing, secular Jews, the kibbutznikim, well, they weren't kibbutznikim yet because the first kibbutz hadn't been started, but you know what I mean. You have to consult with the Rosh Yeshiva. They can give you wisdom. On the other hand, the ideal of Israel's national renaissance, including all the material accoutrement, which is a proper thing joined to the spiritual goal, today does not succeed. And the lack of our success in 1904 has brought on infighting until finally the leader of the movement has fallen a victim of frustration. That's Herzl. It behooves us to take heart to try and unify the tree of Yosef and the tree of Yehuda, to rejoice in the national reawakening and to know that this is not the end goal of Israel, but is only a preparation. And you can read the rest yourself. Now, that's really important as a speech. That became the founding, if you like, ideology of religious Zionism. Now, religious Zionism had been started way before secular Zionism. Religious Zionism started in the 1870s, maybe in the 1780s, in the Vilna Gaon, if you want to say he's one of the first religious Zionists in that sense, not in the modern sense. Secular Zionism was born in the 1890s with Herzl. However, he's saying that the future of religious Zionism has to be a bridge, has to be a bridge of connecting the Haredim and the secular Jews. So you guys are the glue that will glue everything together. Because in theory, the secular, the religious Zionists, they get the secular Jews because they also believe in Israel and the army and building the country, and they get what they're on about. And they get the Haredi Jews because they learn in yeshiva and they know what the importance of Torah and the importance of people learning full-time Torah to protect the country. They get both sides. If you get both sides, then you'll be able to glue them together. Now, did this work?
Yes.
I don't know. I think all of those answers are correct. No, yes, and not yet. Meaning this was 122 years ago. If Rav Kook would have walked into Jerusalem today, I mean, you can tell him, yeah, but there's like people are fighting and this and the other. I mean, he would have looked around and, I mean, I don't know. But I imagine he would have just been crying for joy at what the country has built. Think of what Israel looked like in 1904 under the Ottomans. And look what Israel looks like today. It's unbelievable. On the other hand, a lot of the fighting has still not been solved. And issues come up every now and then that make it, you know, even more clear. What's going on right now is exactly this. And it's been going on and off for the last 124 years, quite honestly. And the question is, how are we going to resolve this? The religious Zionist community is feeling a little bit today like, I don't know if they can be a bridge or not a bridge. They try to be a bridge, but the problem with trying to be a bridge is that everybody hates you. Yeah? The Haredi Jews turn around and say, you're not really from. Your Torah is not really Torah, which is what they say. Yeah? And the secular Jews say, you're just the same as all the frommers. Mm-hmm. Yeah? My wife has sat next to people on planes. She's sat next to a non-observant Israeli woman that turned around to her and said, Datiim don't fight in the army. Religious people don't fight in the army. Like,
in your sense,
what are you talking about? The army is full, literally, of guys wearing kippot. Religious Zionists? What do you mean, Datim? Oh, yeah, Datim, Haridim, it's all the same. It's all the same? Yeah, because the secular community is seeing, oh, all the frummers are the same. All this Torah is nonsense. And the Haredi community says, yeah, all the Datim people are just secular. You're just secular. You're just like them. You watch movies like them. Yeah. Fine. So you have to somehow get these people to recognize that the religious Zionist community may be part of the solution. And the religious Zionist community feels very torn. Like, everybody hates them. Yeah? The Haredim don't think they're frum, and the seculars think that they're Haredi. What are you going to do? But this is the challenge that Rav Kook lays down. This is actually fascinating, and this is Mashiach ben Yosef. So it could be what we're experiencing right now is Mashiach ben Yosef. That's the process. That's the wars. That's the fighting. That's the fighting our enemies. That's the fighting our each other. And therefore, don't think it's just all part of a disaster. It might be all part of the solution. Yes?
About ben Yosef, mm-hmm. or Israel representing the businessman Jew,
yes,
or like
yes.
the Jew who experiences universalism.
Yes.
It's kind of hard, in my opinion, to see it that way, because when you look at the early secular Zionists, like, for example, the way many of them raised their children, some of them were even raising their children to be Christian, like Herzl, for example. Or if you asked Weizmann, I think there's like a famous conversation where someone asked him, like, oh, do you want Israel to be like Albania? And there was like this comment made where he said, oh, Albania, no one knows what's that. So, yes, I want it to be like Albania.
Right.
So, like, it's not that these people are businessmen or they live in the world. It's just that they were so detached from
correct.
The idea of being a Jew that they weren't even really
correct, but the 20th century has given us a lot of perspective on that mistake. Because the same secular religious Jews now, after the Second World War, will say, it won't help if we just hide away and go live in Albania. It won't help. They'll find us. It won't even help if we become Christians. It won't even help if our children are born Christians. If they have one Jewish grandparent, someone's going to come banging on the door and pull them away and put them in a concentration camp.
Yeah.
We learned that lesson, right? And I think secular Jews today don't think like they thought in 1904. And secular Israelis, by the way, don't think like they thought in 2022 either. Mm. There's a very big difference the way people perceive the world now than they did 3 years ago. Very big difference. Has it solved all the problems? No, but it's very, very different. One thing is for sure, which everyone who I think, you know, understands the situation is saying this, is that whatever narratives you have are all wrong. They're all wrong. Whatever you think secular Jews are, it's not. People talk like this. They talk about, oh, Tel Aviv. So as if Tel Aviv is a place which is just like a secular city. Have you been to Tel Aviv recently? Have you seen the French for taken over, you know? It's like a new world. There's so many religious things going on in Tel Aviv. There are Kiruv Minyanim in Tel Aviv. There's like, you know, it's not like Yerushalayim, but even Yerushalayim's not Yerushalayim. Ah, Yerushalayim, Minag Yerushalayim. What are you talking about? There's so many different communities. Everything's different. People cling on to these narratives. If you make Aliyah, your children won't be frum. What does that even mean? Define. Why? What's your evidence for that, etc.? If you stay in America, you'll marry out. It's not true. There's Jews in all these places. So as long as you don't go with the narratives and start challenging these narratives, then you'll probably be better off. But the question is, what's really happening? But I love Rav Kook because I think he's really kind of almost prophetically called it for today. And we'll see what happens with this. But that's a very important perspective on Mashiach. Yes, Kayla.
I have two questions. Back in source 7, these new tribulations shall be the final test for Israel. So is there any way that we don't pass that test?
I don't know. Like Rambam said yesterday, we don't really know how it's all going to work until it's all worked out. The process that we're in now, is it a process which is a 2-year process or a 200-year process?
So why is this rabbi saying this?
Yeah, but he's not predicting. He's saying that in the generalizations. Let me ask you a question. When the Jews came into Israel to build the land of Israel with Yahushua, how long did it take them to get the act together and have a proper Jewish king? Hundreds and hundreds of years. All the time of Yahushua, all the time of Sefer Shoftim, all the time of Shmuel Aleph, until eventually you have Shaul, who is a disaster, and then David. Oh, David HaMelech. It took 400 years. We've got to be patient. You know, how old is Israel? 78? Maybe when we're 278 years in, then it'll be... Like, everyone's really impatient, right? Oh, it's never going to happen. I don't know. Everything in the Second Temple, how long did it take them when the Jews came back with Zerubbabel to get their act together and get a temple? It like took them so long until Ezra and Nehemiah came back. It takes time. And even then, most of the Jews stayed in Babylon. So patience is part of the recipe for successful Jewish history, I think. But we'll see. But yeah, I mean, he's not describing a specific thing. He's describing generalizations. I don't know how long it's going to take. Everyone wants Mashiach now, right? Not happening, sorry. Yes.
So I just want to make sure I'm understanding. If the idea is if we do tshuva as like all Klal Yisrael does tshuva, whatever that means. Like there won't be this Mashiach when there won't be a need for Mashiach when.
Or it'll work out differently. Or it'll work out differently. There'll be wars which we fight, which we win, as opposed to wars which we fight, which we lose. I don't know.
Okay.
Every Jew that gets on a plane and comes to Israel is part of this on a certain level. Yeah, there's lots to say. Okay, fine. Leave it there for today, and we will continue tomorrow with Gilgulim and Triat HaMetim.